Greetings, listener. I am Syl, representing the Galatron Corporation from Thoros Beta. And it is my duty to welcome you to the second episode of TV Green Countdown, the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments, for which we have acquired the audio streaming rights for Thoros Alphan territories only. But no matter, this is an installment full of more delicious morsels than a gumblejack stuffed with marshmallows fed upon Vandalusian pom squelches. Roll the trailer.
What Paris has, it has an ethos, a life.
I don't know. I always wanted to come to one, and thought, why not?
Awfully convenient, isn't it? That whenever the TARDIS malfunctions, it always materializes just when there's a crisis going.
AD, the year when human beings are turned into living dead men, noblemen, the underground slaves of the world's new dictators.
I trust that taster has your juices flowing. Excellent. Let the oral banquet begin.
Here we go then. At number 40, the Montage of Death.
Something wrong?
Yeah, just trying to come up with an opening sequence for this part of the podcast. Might just throw in a whooshy noise and some big band music.
Yes? What is it? What do you want?
A really good clip of Clara, please, Doctor, that's going to sync nicely with the music track.
Sorry, but you're about to make a very big mistake.
Yeah, might be too late for that. I'm in a bit of an editing pickle.
I don't know where I am.
Ah, and that's because there's been a jump in the sound treatment on your voice, which makes this whole sequence now sound very discordant.
So what do we do? Time for a plan. Do you have a plan?
Well, yes, I've just hatched it there, actually, by lifting a line of your dialogue from a bit in Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS, where there's not too much incidental music under the action.
You clever boy.
Do you think? Not really. I'm only doing this because I was a little curious about the mechanics of montaging together Doctor Who clips.
Yes, it all started out as a mild curiosity, and now it's turned out to be quite a great-spirited adventure, don't you think?
The truth is, it's very difficult to stitch together different clips from different eras of Doctor Who and make something that seems at all cohesive, let alone something you can convincingly interact with, let alone something which, in the case of the incredible opening sequence to this year's series finale, The Name of the Doctor, also has to mix together unbelievably disparate video footage. For example, look, here comes Doctor Who William Hartnell as a 16mm tele recording of a black and white 405 line video production, and yet he's somehow interacting with an HD full colour background and an HD full colour Jenna Louise, as she was back then, Coleman, while being in HD and full colour himself.
Sheer poetry, dear boy.
Plus, oh, there's Patrick Troughton, Nick from the Five Doctors and relocated via some fine composite work, and a less accomplished body double to a Miami beachfront.
Come on in, the water's lovely! You don't know what you're missing!
And John Pertwee also lifted out of the 20th anniversary story.
Jehoshaphat.
Jehoshaphat. Did you ever really say that back in the day, Doctor? I'm honestly not sure.
I've never heard such arrant nonsense.
Keep your wig on.
Don't try to make a fool of me.
Didn't mean you, Anthony Ainley.
I tried. Sorry.
I don't know where you're coming from, Brigadier, because you're not in this bit. But, listeners, you can hear how easy it is for this kind of Tom Guffrey to get away from you, to lose focus and simply sling in a fun Tom Baker clip from Invasion of Time on the flimsy pretext that a bit from that story was also used in The Name of the Doctor.
Even the sonic screwdriver won't get me out of this one.
So, let's quit with the novelty clips and simply point out how terrific it was that even on the cusp of middle age, brand new Doctor Who was still enough of a fanboy to weave some fan fiction around its own past glories. And the jiggering about with the show's past isn't going to end there if that celebratory 50 years free as a bird style trailer thing released in October is anything to go by.
The Day of the Doctor.
One thing I don't get is where the 11th Doctor is actually supposed to be at the end of that piece.
Full of sand everywhere!
Yeah, thanks for the insight, Brig.
And I tell you, that's a beach out there. It's probably in Norfolk or somewhere like that.
Oh, come on, man. Can't you be more specific? Narrow it down to a particular coastal town or something.
I tried. Sorry.
Something wrong?
Yeah, just trying to come up with an opening sequence for this part of the podcast.
Well, here we go again.
Come on, Alistair, you had your chance. I had your clip all sequenced up, ready to go.
Number 39, an altogether more far-flung shore.
Let's face it. We can debate the rights and the wrongs of Series 24. Oh, alright then, Season 24. All day. But if you're going to start wittering about pantomime embarrassment and trying to make out that Captain Culloch's incidental music was any less annoying, intrusive, overbearing, or just plain too bloody loud the Murray Gold's contributions, then the debate's over and you're wrong. Sorry, you were warned. Anyway, despite what TV's Dominic Sandbrook might have to say on the subject, Season 24 had its good points, but the continuity announcement before that all-important first episode of Time and the Rani was not one of them. True, the BBC was sort of letting its hair down a bit in the late 80s, what with the broom cupboard and open air, and that thing on BBC Two where they sort of vox pop people outside gigs about their favourite pop video or whatever it was. But even so, nobody could have been quite prepared for the sheer barrage of cheery feigned enthusiasm that heralded Sylvester McCoy's debut appearance as the Doctor. A new series, a new physical form, and a journey to an altogether more far-flung shore. Sylvester McCoy stars as Doctor Who! So ran the bewildering, glow-backed introduction, delivered in tones that suggested that viewers were about to witness something akin to the Elvis comeback special on ice, in 3D, with surround sound, and where you won things by watching, rather than some good-natured and visually impressive running around in the quarry, with Kate O'Mara breaking international health conventions on hamming it up, and too many synth banjos on the soundtrack. It's often been said that the surviving bits of continuity are the real highlights of the classic Doctor Who DVDs, and that may well be true, but if they offer revealing glimpses of what the BBC was like at the time, then this is the self-portrait taken on the fun camera on a Club 1830 holiday that they're all trying to forget.
Number 38. Carry On Abroad!
How to pep up an ailing show. Ever so simply, why not think of a place to go outside this country? Done and done. But wait, can't be too costly. Must be quite sunny and attractive, full of lots of funny tourists, with lots of places to run about excessively. Then, and only then, can Doctor Who pack up its bags, collect its traveller's checks and carry on abroad. Okay, before anyone writes in, I know this is the title theme to Carry On Doctor, not Carry On Abroad. But Carry On Abroad doesn't have as good a title theme as Carry On Doctor, even though it's a better film.
Well, I'm the representative of Wonder Tours, Stuart Farquhar. Stupid what?
Anyway, for a man with the ability to travel anywhere in time and space, it's laudable, or laughable, depending on your point of view, that it took 16 whole years before Doctor Who actually filmed anywhere outside the UK. First came Paris in 1979, the best of the excursions by far, thanks to it being the most fun and the least pointless.
It's the only place in the universe where one can relax entirely.
Mmm,
the bouquet.
What Paris has, it has an ethos, a life. It has...
A bouquet?
A spirit, all of its own. Like a wine, it has...
A bouquet.
It has a bouquet.
Paris was somewhere people wanted to see on Doctor Who, because it was somewhere they wanted to see for themselves. It was also somewhere people could believe that Doctor Who would want to be seen. The upshot was one of the most entertaining Doctor Who adventures ever.
Shall we take the lift or fly?
Let's not be ostentatious.
All right, let's fly then.
That would look silly. We'll take the lift. Come on.
Unfortunately, it was this sense of purpose, rather than the Doctor Who production team's passports, that were about to get mislaid. Energised by the chance to get his tongue around more foreign parts, producer John Nathan Turner stepped up his efforts to have sex with Doctor Who fans. Meanwhile, he also tried to film more of the shows abroad. Unlike the sex, these produced diminishing returns. There was Amsterdam in 1983, another popular European city, though not blessed with the same visual grandeur as Paris, and, plot-wise, a place Doctor Who didn't choose to visit, making the excursion feel superficial, which it was. Look, a canal! Listen, a hurdy-gurdy! And breathless, convoluted exposition!
Can't be far ahead.
How much time do we have?
I don't know. The magnetic shield is in accelerated decay now.
What'll happen?
He'll revert to antimatter.
The following year came Lanzarote, which was meant to be a foreign planet called Sarn. Both looked shit. Then, in 1985, came Seville, and the most shameless jaunt yet. There was absolutely no reason for Doctor Who to be here in terms of plot, character, or even style. All the bits of Spain that got put on screen looked rotten. Though, given the script, perhaps that was only fitting.
Do they ever eat their own?
I believe in the Far Indies, as has been known. But I remember a dish. Shepherd's pie.
A shepherd's pie. A shepherd. Can't we walk quicker?
As ratings began to dwindle, so did the production team's horizons. They'd forgotten the first rule of a TV hit.
It's fairly easy to get it up. It's getting it to stay up. That's what counts.
Seville was the last proper foreign jaunt until 2008, when the show went off to Rome to use the inside of a studio. I say proper jaunt because there was that feature-length one-off thing in 1996 set in San Francisco, though seeing as the whole thing was made in the US, it doesn't count. What perhaps should count, however, are all those times Doctor Who has carried on abroad, but from the earthy confines of the BBC studios. There was somewhere on prehistoric Earth, Central Asia in 1289, 15th century Mexico, Paris in 1794, Rome in 64 AD, 12th century Palestine, New York, the Maris Celeste, ancient Rome, ancient Egypt, Paris again. Australia and 15th century Italy. Time spent in which proving just as entertaining as a real foreign fling, often more so and without the need for visas, injections, suppositories or any of that continental sauce. After all, why bother with a full package when all any of us could really do with is a bit?
Number 37. As easy as pie.
So, here we are at the Academy on Gallifrey for some mathematics night classes about pie. It's a busy place. Don't know why it's in the Dark Tower. Well, that's annoying. Hope that doesn't happen much. Anyway, not sure where to go here. So we can hear.
What is pi? Pi is the ratio of the circumference over the diameter. Pi is an irrational number that is equal to approximately 3.14159. To better explain pi, let's go over the parts of a circle. First, there is the circumference, which is the perimeter of the circle. Then there is the diameter, which is a line that splits the circle in half. Then there's the radius, which is...
I'm a bit dull, not very practical. I'll try this one.
Pi. What is pi? Well, pretty much all of us know that pi is approximately 3.14, but that doesn't really tell us much about pi. What is pi? How did it get its name? Who discovered it? And how did they approximate it? Well, that's a lot to explain.
Not much better. Once again.
The circumference of any circle is a little more than 3 times its diameter. In other words, the ratio of circumference to diameter is about 3.14, a fundamental constant of nature denoted by the Greek letter pi.
I appreciate the musical accompaniment, but it's not much more enlightening.
As easy as pie.
What's that?
As easy as pie.
Who's this guy?
That's what he said.
No, he didn't. He said easy as pie, the Greek letter pi. Surely you know some basic mathematics, child?
Oh, this is much more like it.
The ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter is represented by the Greek letter pi, right?
Exactly. You find the safe part by using the mathematical formula pi.
Well, yeah, but what about the application?
Oh, but the application. Now, let me see now. 3.14159 265. Yes, that's it.
I hope you've got your sums right.
So do I. Now, I always thought pi was about circles and things, as opposed to an equation with a random application to wander across giant chessboards without being struck by lightning. Oh well, what do I know?
Number 36. Premature male pattern baldness, an oscilloscope, and a frock coat.
Premature male pattern baldness, an oscilloscope, a frock coat, a nice cup of tea, a church hall, the local woods. Unseen enemy monitoring events from a TV screen. Someone with poor diction. An attempted moment of distilled doctorishness, usually involving a nice cup of tea. Running through puddles along a gravelly footpath. A spaceship spins on its axis pointlessly. A title sequence. The wrong font. The word who as wide as the word doctor. This music. Almost as long as there has been Doctor Who, there have been Doctor Who fan films, and that was a list of stuff that tends to turn up in them. Be they processions of toy Daleks immortalised on Super 8, or more elaborate productions involving homemade TARDIS exteriors, there is something about the pull of performing your very own Who adventure that keeps driving Who fans behind and in front of the camera. For years, only the most dedicated and ambitious Doctor Who fan films would ever be seen beyond the front room of the production team's mum's house. In 1987, Real Time Pictures produced Wartime, a sensibly reined-in story featuring Sergeant Benton and a long static shot of some woods. Oh, and a weird psychological trip into Benton's past. It's the only prominent fan film that we're aware of, which originated from before the show was yanked off the air in 1989. Mind you, it's our understanding that Wartime was in fact an authorised spin-off, so it doesn't really count here.
But it's real, it's true, I still got the letter!
Moving on then. As Sylvester McCoy wandered off at the end of Survival in search of a fast-cooling evening repast, Whovians became increasingly determined to fill the void left by Doctor Who's tele-demise. The soon-to-be-prolific BBV Productions kicked off their license-baiting series The Stranger in 1991, attempting a much-attempted attempt, by fans at least, of fusing Doctor Who with Sapphire and Steel.
Listen, I don't know who you are, but you are disturbing my contemplation. I no longer have any interest in human affairs, do you understand?
However, like Wartime before it, this wasn't actually Doctor Who at all. Well, not really. One of the more prominent fan enterprises of the early 1990s got its debut at the Dark Tower convention of 1994.
You see, John, there are no Daleks, no Cybermen, no miniature spaceships hurtling around the place, and there are no Time Lords.
Time-based productions were an outfit hailing from Time T's country. Their version of Doctor Who stuck to the fan template of trying to make it as much like the TV series as possible.
But a bit like H.P. Lovecraft as well.
Rupert Booth played the Time Lord as a very young incarnation with a gentle north-easterly lilt.
You're perfectly correct. I'm not a Time Lord. I'm not even a Doctor.
Every planet has a northeast. He was accompanied by a companion who couldn't act very well, and together they faced Cybermen, Sontarans, and supporting characters with strangely fluctuating facial hair, evidence of the prolonged shooting schedule required to complete a time-based production. For all its shortcomings, Booth's Doctor was his own, and this tends to be the way of Who fan films. But not all the time. Doctor Who Time Rift sees notable Whoey nabob Jonathan Bloom impersonating a laryngitis-infected Sylvester McCoy.
Very convenient, isn't it? That whenever the TARDIS malfunctions, it always materializes just when there's a crisis brewing. It's such a coincidence!
Still, there's a lot of pootling around and a little bit of scrubland to distract you from the wandering accent. Time-based productions and Time Rift were the fruit of old-school fans, and they were preoccupied with fandom's view of the programme at that time. Doctor Who was principally an adventure series that tapped into a kind of English eccentricity shared by Biggles and Sherlock Holmes and pipe smokers. Those videotape fan films come from a different age, back when cowboys and Indians came as part of the standard popular culture smorgasbord, along with Charlie Chan repeats and primetime weekday quiz shows. But marooned from those shared cultural reference points and disconnected from a common context from which to watch the show, what would younger fans make of Doctor Who and of the unspoken aesthetic principles that seemed to underpin all fan productions prior to 2005?
I'm of the generation that was deprived of Doctor Who.
Doctor Who fan Ryan Hendrick, talking to TV Cream.
I was born in 1984, and my dad sat me down to watch a bunch of repeats that were on BBC Two in 1992.
Tempted to the television by his father, and which Whovian Pater would not wish to see their progeny follow in their stead, the cliffhanger to episode 3 of Caves of Androzani was enough to hook the young Ryan.
Ones in Genesis, but then Caves of Androzani came on and, quite frankly, scared the hell out of me and just grabbed me. That cliffhanger completely had me terrified and thinking about that closing moment for a whole week.
So you see, I'm not going to let you stop me now!
Pretty much round about then I started to get ideas of writing my own scripts. So I was writing one-page Doctor Who scripts. And did that for a number of years, and then ended up recording my own little audio dramas with my uncle and my sister. Eventually you develop and you move on and you start writing original material. I wanted to become an actor, I wanted to become a filmmaker, and that was back and forth.
Like many Who fans, Ryan thought he'd left it all behind, but over time he was inevitably drawn back to the show, rather like the TARDIS drawn to that tractor beam at the beginning of Trial of a Time Lord, or Colin Baker to a pie-eating contest with Tony Selby marshalling the opposing flan knife.
I became aware of the idea of making a fan film when I was around 13, when I went to secondary school. One of the prefects in 6 year, who was looking after our class, figured out I was a big Doctor Who fan, and so was she. And she was a member of the local Glasgow Who group. And she took me along to one of their meetings. They had written a script, and I still remember the name. It was called Revival. And it was a really interesting script. It was quite scary, and set in Glasgow city centre at night. And they were planning to do it. I don't think they ever did it. I'm not sure, but I was aware that that idea, that kind of inspired me right there. So, oh, I can do that. I can go do one.
And while the Glasgow Doctor Who Society got sidetracked with other projects, probably Alan McGowan's Perzine, or an agreeable term listing suggested Blue Peter presenters' spin-off projects. Peter's Perverts, anyone?
Sorry, this is... one shouldn't laugh.
Ryan didn't forget. By around 2008...
HD technology has just become readily available to anyone. We can all go buy a Canon 5D Mark II for 500 quid.
There was just one further push required. Ryan was doing
an acting for camera course
when his group was asked to improvise a scene around the following lines.
That's the last one. A are you sure? Definitely. What's that?
These lines were the seeds of what was to become his entree into the world of Doctor Who fan films.
There are worlds out there. Millions of them.
So, Besieged, written and produced by and starring Ryan Hendrick. It started out as a short film in which Doctor Who takes a step into the world of the Ridley Scott / James Cameron Alien franchise.
Is it always like that?
No, not all the time.
After a positive response from fandom, Ryan decided it was time to push the boat out and create his own feature-length Doctor Who adventure.
We shot it in 21 days, in brackets, over this space of a year. It was such a challenging production. I really enjoyed it. It was a nightmare as well.
But for someone trying to make their way in the world of professional filmmaking, why would you want to invest time, energy and money into a film that will A, never make you any money, and B, is clearly labelled as a non-professional enterprise?
Well, when you make micro-budget films, the hardest part is getting it to an audience or finding your audience. And that's all, that usually becomes a sticking point. So you never know whether your creative voice works. So to be able to kind of do something that you know has an audience that will get general feedback, genuine feedback from the general public who are your target audience, who you want to go and watch your work, to respond, to find out if they respond to the way you are trying to create. It's great.
Promoting the film has taken the Besieged team on the convention circuit, and in the process thrust Ryan into an odd space in the pecking order of fandom.
I don't know, it's kind of somewhere in between. It's kind of, I'm not really a full-on guest, but I'm not there as a paying member of the public either. It's kind of a strange thing. You're kind of given funny looks by both the celebrities and the fans.
It's a difficult thing, this stepping into the fan film business, because, first of all, it isn't a business, and secondly, there are Who fans out there ready and waiting to not take into account your lack of funds or lack of Scottish dialect training.
It's such a coincidence!
When they tear apart your masterpiece. And let's face it, once you've committed to camera your best attempt at technobabble or a doctorish put-down, it's there preserved on VHS or, these days, online, ready to come back and haunt you at any point.
I am getting better, aren't I?
Yes, John, you're getting better.
I don't want to die, Christopher. It's stupid, was stupid.
I said enough!
The airflow in this room is coming in two different directions.
Who are you shouting at anyway?
The Time Lords! They've dragged the TARDIS off course because they've got another mission for me. Once again, they're sticking my nose in with their lily-white hands for you to tread.
Really gets up you when somebody else is pulling the strings, doesn't it?
Hey.
You need my help? No. Whatever you heard about me, it's not true. Not anymore!
Yeah, so a year of rather intense sandwich making.
Number 35. Grandfather Who.
For millions of children around the world, Doctor Who's space-time ship has sailed through five decades, shorn of one particular article. The definite article.
This is TARDIS. TARDIS?
Yes, TARDIS.
It stands for time and relative dimension in space.
That's dimension, not dimensions.
But it's so big in here, and yet it's so small from outside.
And that's because it's a
record breaker. If you're the tallest, the smallest, if you beat them all, if you're the fattest.
Were the McWhirters still with us, they might surmise, in between boring you with the fastest speed ever achieved by a land mammal, that Peter Cushing's Doctor Who remains the most watched and statistically the most popular incarnation of that character on the planet.
If you can fly like a bird, if you can play the highest note ever.
If you see a man with long grey hair and a funny little smile on his face.
And it's easy to agree. Cushing's two big screen appearances as Grandfather Who have penetrated more countries more often than any small screen counterpart. For at least three generations, he's been the most syndicated and highest-grossing Doctor, starring in the best-funded and most commercially obtainable adventures. For ages, you could buy or rent a copy of 1965's Doctor Who and the Daleks, or 1966's Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD, far easily than any of the BBC stories. And with the likes of Roy Castle, Bernard Cribbins, and
Ray Brooks, the boy with the knack.
Why wouldn't you?
This is 2150 AD, the year when human beings are turned into living dead men, robo-men, the underground slaves of the world's new dictators.
In the 60s, this was your chance to see Doctor Who a gazillion times bigger and noisier than the version at home.
So close, you can feel their fire. So thrilling, you must be there.
Barbara, look behind you!
And in the 80s, when the films were turning up every summer on Saturday mornings on BBC One, this was your chance to see Doctor Who a gazillion times better than the version now being flung out on weeknights up against Wish You Were Here on ITV at home.
Stop the countdown! The bomb will destroy the planet!
An alarm bell! They know we've escaped!
What Cushing's Doctor lost in subtlety, he more than made up for in charm. Given the choice, he's much more your ideal grandfather than William Hartnell. He talked to you, for one thing.
It began just as you see here.
Do you know what you have just done? You have transferred us in time and space, and I hadn't even set the controls. Now I don't know where we are. We could be anywhere in the universe, and at any time.
Yes, this is how it began.
Professor Who did a better job of explaining time travel as well.
When I push that lever, this room and everything in it will dissolve into their respective component electrical charges. We're all made up of them. These charges will then be transferred in time and space and reassembled in their proper order and their proper place.
In short, Peter Cushing played a more substantial role in popularising and humanising Doctor Who than any of his small screen equivalents. Let's not forget him.
Come with us into that strange new world. I cannot guarantee your safety, but I can promise you unimagined thrills.
Number 34. The Doctor Who Appreciation Society blows it.
Was too long to wait, but when they finally did bring back the Doctor in 1986, after that spot of bother, his fan club didn't hesitate to celebrate the fact at their annual convention held at Imperial College London. This was to be a dizzying whirlwind of an event, as fans were swept away not only by the concept that
the venerable Time Lord faces Inquisition in the much-awaited return of Doctor Who,
but also the sheer excitement implicit in the fact this year marked the 10th anniversary of the Doctor Who Appreciation Society itself. Emotions ran high.
What made you come all the way to this convention?
A short-sleeved Nicholas Briggs there, accosting one excitable Whovian on a stairwell.
Well, I don't know. I always wanted to come to one, and thought, why not? May as well.
While fans eloquently gave voice to their exuberance, the Society's representatives also shared in these good times.
Yan and Steve were the last of the really old guard to resign, and it looked somewhat at the time as if the Society was going into a decline. Maybe it would even have come to an end.
Meanwhile, Mark Turlow Strickson, dressed in a shapeless grey textured suit and gingham shirt, also tapped into the mounting hysteria.
I don't mind doing conventions, I have to say. I think I've done two in Swindon.
The culmination of this magical Saturday came at a little before 5:45 p.m. with a live feed from BBC One playing out on the big screen. The Society's top knob led the countdown to Doctor Who's much-anticipated return.
Five, four, three, just some of the two, new programs starting one, next week on Children's Show. Now the continuity announcer. Quiet, please, everybody.
New series of tele-addies. First of venerable time, right. Inquisition and much awaited return of Doctor Who.
Still, it was heartening to hear a small ripple there for tele-addicts.
Is that it? Are we finished?
Number 33. Doctor in the Charts.
This is a journey into sound.
Thanks, Jeff.
Stereophonic sound.
You're right. Sick. Anyway, here in the exciting, hip-to-the-jive 21st century, with its DVD extras and digital channels and ting, it's easy to forget how much time and effort we all used to invest in scouring the airways for any sort of reference to popular children's television programme Doctor Who. Even when the thing was still on air, one episode a week was hardly ever going to be enough, especially if those episodes featured Bertie Bassett going tonto or robot lobsters in swimming pools.
There's no one there!
So the slightest reference was seized upon with gusto.
Join in and sing this with gusto, there's gusto.
That ranged from overly attentive tuning in to children's programmes on a Saturday morning to catch a glimpse of one of the popular stars of the day.
Well, Doctor Who is back. You can see him a little bit later today. Well, in fact, to be honest, you can see him right now. Tom Baker, welcome. And Elizabeth Sladen, welcome to Swap Shop. Tell me a little bit about the new series. It looks all a bit frightening.
Yes, it is. It's very frightening and very tense and very exciting. And very secret. Terribly secret. I can't really tell you. I can't go into the details.
No, not a clue.
To gazing longingly at police boxes in the background of Taggart.
Maybe I could write you off with a suspension and a broken nose.
Or if you were really lucky, maybe something like this.
Maybe the most brilliant scientist in the world, with two hearts and several hundred years of age, but I haven't the faintest idea what I'm doing here.
And then, in the middle of the seemingly endless void between Dragonfire and Remember of the Daleks, came, in May 1988, this... Was it an affectionate tribute? Was it a piss take? Was it a cynical exercise in demonstrating how easy it was to get to number one in the artistic wasteland of the commercial hit parade? Well, who gave a shit? It was Doctor Who, sort of, on Top of the Pops. So, okay, the Daleks in the video were a bit hon-knitted, and the conceit that the song was produced and performed by an American police car got a bit tiresome, but by Jove, it certainly made our summer. Suddenly, it was all right to say you like Doctor Who again. Us kids loved it. And naturally, Melody Maker described it as pure, unadulterated agony. Excruciating. Sounds said that this rancid reworking of ancient discs was a record so noxious that a top 10 place can be its only destiny. Yes, well, number one, actually. But how their metallic teeth must have begun to grind, as Select later reported it had sold over 1 million copies.
OK, I don't know what that means, but something will happen, no doubt.
And nowadays it's not heard very much, possibly because of the fairly prominent Gary Glitter thread running through, which, has to be said, is rather less commercial now than it was 25 years ago. But what Doctor in the TARDIS by the Time Lords did demonstrate is that lots of people loved Doctor Who, which you might have expected would have put a spring in the show's step. Not long after, it was gone. But by the time this thing came along in 2001, Doctor Who was but a whisper in university computer rooms and the odd, faintly stinky halls of residence. Eccles was years away, the TV movie but a distant memory.
Timing malfunction. The Master. He's out there.
Doctor Who was not cool.
Bug report. When a guy asked me to spend time with him, maybe he planned something a little more interesting than hanging out at home watching TV.
Even Doctor Who.
So this footering about with the theme by the torchlit noggins of Orbital was rather a bolt out of the blue, and being able to identify the sample of Tomb of the Cybermen at the outset of the live version suddenly got an impressed raised eyebrow, rather than the gob in the face betraying such knowledge would have drawn not that long before. Oh, modern life, it's just so fickle.
Get me the Brigadier at once, he can maybe enlighten me.
Number 32. A couple of seconds of extra moving about.
At the time of recording, we're all still reeling from the recovery of a massive 9 previously missing episodes of Doctor Who, and 2 more not long before that, and rumours persist that there's even more to come. So it's more than a little strange to think back to only a couple of years ago, when everyone, and that's everyone, from Ian Levine to people who half watch the new series repeats on BBC Three while doing the ironing and take the odd phone call halfway through, not unreasonably assumed that the missing episode well had long since run dry, and that anything that was at all reasonably likely to be found anywhere had already been found, and that all those errant prints of Assassin at Peking had been binned decades ago. As such, expectations were so low that even the briefest of fragments of a missing episode being found had become a serious talking point, such as when a couple of seconds of extra moving about from the 1966 story The Power of the Daleks showed up in clip format on tedious issue exploring Sunday morning BBC show or other, and the entire internet promptly burst. Similar excitement, but slightly better reason, greeted the discovery by BBC Archives type Andrew Martin of some unlabeled waste film that turned out to actually be offcuts from two missing late 60s stories, Fury from the Deep and The Space Pirates. The former, it has to be said, was a particularly excitement-warranting rediscovery, giving as it did some sense of an impression of how the dramatic foam French climax to a story that almost nothing visual had previously survived from might have looked. The latter, well, it's some model shots of vaguely spacey shapes moving about very, very slowly on a plain black background, seemingly with a running time of 8 million years, and that's if you watch it on fast forward. In fact, they're probably still going on somewhere. If the Space Pirates is amongst this purported elephant-sized haul of lost episodes, chances are its permanently lowly reputation is not about to be enhanced in any direction other than downwards, or, if raining, across space. Very, very, very slowly.
And at number 31, when Hamish Wilson joined the Clan MacCrimmon.
Science fiction freak from way back. My dear Aunt Jenny bought me a subscription to Boots Library in Sucky Hall Street, and I emptied, well not emptied, but I read all their science fiction in 2 months. You know, and that was A.E. Van Vogt and Asimov and Ray Bradbury and all these people. And when I heard that the BBC were going to do a programme about time travel, I thought, oh, that's great. Science fiction on television, that's great. And Hartnell, of course, I knew because I'd seen him in so many movies. And then when I heard they were going back to Culloden, I thought, they're not going to change the score, are they? And that's, of course, where Fraser appeared. And then went on the travels with the Doctor and the lovely Wendy Panbury. My agent called me. I was working in an office in London because, as you know, actors have to go on doing jobs if they're not doing the real work that they do. And I got this phone call from my agent saying, are you very busy? And I said, no more than normally. No, why?
Jamie?
He said, well, BBC want you for a Doctor Who.
Jamie, is that you? Oh, Jamie!
He said, just go straight down to this place. So I did. I went straight down. And there was Patrick and Wendy and the director. And I was told that Fraser was ill. And I was going to... They had rewritten the script, apparently, in kind of 24 hours. And that's how they got me in, by Patrick having to do... Doctor Who having to do the puzzle and he gets it wrong.
Oh! Oh, now I've lost his face!
I see. I'm supposed to provide the face, am I? Mm-hmm. Very well. Now then. Yes.
Instead of Fraser's face, we get my face. And there I was for two episodes, being Jamie.
Doctor! Oh, I'm glad to see you again.
Patrick and Wendy were super, because they... You know, we would do a bit, block a bit, and then we'd rehearse it two or three times so that I knew exactly what... And they were saying, now, you sure, are you happy about that? You know what you're doing? I'm covering the script in pencil marks and so on and so on. And they took it home that night and learned it. I mean, there wasn't a lot to learn, but I knocked it home anyway. I thought that the best thing to do was do the performance as best I could. I didn't try to imitate Fraser, because I thought that would be wrong, and wrong in terms of the story as well. So I just played it. I remembered a couple of the ways he used to move, and I tried to incorporate that. But that's all I did in terms of referring it back to Fraser. We did the first episode on the day following my blocking the scenes. And then the next one, it was a standard rehearsal process, and Fraser reappeared, I think, pretty well on the first day, on the read-through of the next episode. And I vanished at the end of that.
Jamie, thank goodness you're back.
Back? What do you mean back? I haven't been anywhere.
You've got your face back.
I have? Yes, where? Look. Oh, you're right, I have. Oh, that's much better.
I think, considering the brevity of the rehearsal period, it wasn't bad. I'd have been very happy to be involved in Doctor Who long term.
Jamie?
And Jamie?
Well, yeah, that would have caused confusion, wouldn't it?
Nothing is impossible.
I watched the series, and I watched it. I mean, I thought David Tennant was super. I think that Matt Smith has been terrific. And the girls, all the women have been in it, I think have been super. I'm very aware that they have been quietly sidestepping some of the great conventions, and I think everybody is currently wondering how they're going to address the theoretical last manifestation of the Doctor and what is going to happen thereafter.
That's something we must all accept, Doctor.
Thank you. Not the Master. No, he had some sort of plan. That's why he came here, Ian.
After the 12th regeneration, there is no plan that will postpone death.
I worked for about 2 years as an announcer at STV, and we used to do voiceover slide commercials. So you get a very, very close understanding of how long something lasts. The difference between 7 seconds, 10 seconds, 15 seconds. And of course there was a game of chicken that the announcers used to play. They won't do it now, they'd be far too responsible. But on commercial television in those days, news at 10 was the big flagship news bulletin. and on STV we had a 15-second clock, and you'd do the announcement. It would be something like, "You're tuned to Scottish Television, serving Central and Southern Scotland. The time here on STV is 10 o'clock, and we crossed at the studios of ITN, where Sandy Gall and Reginald Bosanquet are waiting with news at 10. And you mustn't crash the banks. Dum, 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 you know, all of that." And so the game of chicken was you did it without looking at the clock. I had a wee stopwatch, and I used to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, so that you get the timing right. Because if it's a seven second slide, you subtract a second from each end, because they've got to fade the picture up and fade it back down again. And it's all that kind of thing. So that's fascinating. It's great fun. It did seem a little odd from time to time when you'd have to say at 9:15, "Lewis's sale on now." You know, the shop's been shut for 6 hours. But yeah, no, I enjoyed doing that kind of work. It was good fun. I do remember on one occasion, I was on a bus going up to the studio, actually, and there was a wee old lady who wasn't too sure on her feet, and so I stopped and turned around to make sure that she didn't fall when she stepped off the bus. And she said, "Thank you, son." I said, "You're very welcome." She said, "Oh, I know your voice. You're him off the STV." I say good night to you every night. Because when you close the station down, you say, "And from everybody here at STV, have a good night, sleep well." And she said, "I say good night to you every night, son." And I find that very moving. Our youngest daughter was at Dundee University. She told me once when she was home on holiday, "Oh, there's a guy in my year who is a Doctor Who fan." And we were up in Dundee taking Abigail out for a birthday lunch, I think. And peradventure, this guy came walking down the street and Abby introduced me. And he started telling me stuff about Doctor Who and the Mind Robber that I never knew. So I'm not, in that sense, a truly knowledgeable fan of the series. But I do love watching it. Klingon Twat!
"Greetings again. It is I, Syl, come to bid you farewell from this offering from TV Cream. I humbly hope it pleased you, and if you are a Thoris Alphen broadcaster who would be interested in acquiring this commodity for your station or affiliates, then contact me at once on sil_work-related-stuff@talk21.co.tb. But first, here is a small sample of what the next installment offers.
If we can hitch a ride in on one of those three-dimensional geometric shapes from the Wogan title sequence, we might just make it.
Very much a job's worth.
You can't park there, sir. It's more than a job's worth.
They're searching for the place where Doctor Who producer John Nathan Turner.
My name is Debbie Flynn, and I'm a QVC presenter, and we work out of studios in Chiswick. And I've just come off doing an hour of Women with Control Shape Pants, and I'm just about to go back on to do an hour of Fast and Full Things.
And now, I must trundle off. I hear King Yakanos and his hideous wife have made planet fall to discuss new trading rights between the Krontep and the Mentors. I'm hoping to tag on an amendment regarding tax relief for the Lycosa